Planet Money editor, is with us here on The Morning Show as we get straightforward answers to economic questions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So many things influencing our pocketbooks: wages, inflation, income inequality, pricing, interest rates. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said in prepared remarks to Congress yesterday that the economy grew at a strong pace last year, but isn't there always a caveat?
Over the past few months, we have seen some cross currents and conflicting signals. Financial markets have become more volatile toward year end, and financial conditions are now less supportive of growth than they were earlier last year.
So the Fed chairman's remarks didn't give us any solid leads as to whether we'll see interest rate hikes or cuts. What do you want to know about how the central bank works and how interest rates are set and how that ties to your pocketbook? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Patty Hirsch is editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. He's been an economics and finance news correspondent and editor for 20 years. His book, Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple, breaks down our financial system. And he also has a new novel, a historical thriller about Wall Street, titled The Devil's Half Mile. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's lovely to be here. Thanks very much, Kate.
So we were listening yesterday to Fed Chairman Jerome Powell, hanging on every single word, as economists
often do,
right? He talked about these cross currents and conflicting signals. Can you translate the Fed speak for us? What was he saying there?
Well, I think he's just saying that, you know, the world is the world, and you can't sort of gaze into a crystal ball and expect to know everything about, you know, what's going to happen in the world in the next 6 months to a year. This is just the way it always is. And anyone who says, any Fed chairman who sits up and says, oh, we know exactly what's going to happen in the next year, would be a fool. So any statement by any Fed chair at any point in history is always going to be hedged about with all sorts of caveats and warnings about what might be coming down the pike. And it is a particularly tough time, right, for the global economy right now. There's a lot going on. Markets are volatile. There's uncertainty about U.S. trade policy. We've seen a slowdown in Europe and China. So there are all sorts of headwinds that we'd need to be worried about that will play into Fed policy in the future.
It was really interesting. He did list some bigger issues that the Fed is concerned about, issues that many Americans can relate to, like serious wage gaps, especially for communities of color and in rural areas. Like, he's talked about labor participation lower than most advanced countries. What can the Fed do about larger socioeconomic problems?
Well, not very much, frankly. I mean, the Fed really has only one tool that it can use, which is to monkey about with interest rates, you know, which govern the amount that eventually people will be borrowing at, specifically banks. And then, you know, banks will pass on those savings or costs to consumers. So there's not actually a great deal that the Fed can do socioeconomically. It can just kind of make observations about the way things are in the economy. And there are issues in the economy right now, systemic issues as you say, you know, we do have this issue with labor force participation. We do have this issue with inequality. But yeah, those are things that politicians will deal with, and not the Federal Reserve.
And Chairman Powell didn't mention anything about interest rate changes. Is there any hint as to what the Fed might do there?
Yeah, I don't think so right now. I mean, you know, we were looking at Fed hikes coming off the back at the end of last year for the whole of the rest of the year, weren't we, at one point? And then he came back a few weeks ago or a month ago or so, and he said, you know what, no, we're not going to be hiking interest rates anymore. And all that is, those are just indicators. He's just saying, you know, initially things looked pretty rosy at the beginning of the year, but we're starting to see these headwinds now. So no, we're not going to be bringing interest rates up anytime soon. So I think that for me, it's like reading the tea leaves like anything else. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, this sounds to me like he's being pretty conservative. He's leaving himself the option open, but it sounds like to me as though we're not going to see interest rates rise for the rest of the year.
Breaking down economic concepts with Patty Hirsch, our trusted guide. He's the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. What's your question about banking systems or perhaps bailouts? Do you know what private equity means, or questions about commodities? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So we saw this survey come out this week from the National Association of Business Economists, and some business economists not too pleased about making what they see about what might be happening to the U.S. economy, taking a dip perhaps by 2021. So what data points are economists usually looking at when assessing the likelihood that an economy could go into a recession?
Well, there are myriad indicators that people look at. I mean, you've got the housing market. People love the housing market because it's a big indicator of whether or not consumers are going to be spending. Because if people are buying houses, these boxes that they buy all sorts of stuff to put in those boxes. So if the housing market's doing well, then people are, you know, pretty happy about the way the economy's going, and vice versa. Another one, of course, that's connected to that is consumer spending, and you get numbers on that to see, you know, and the indications on consumer spending look pretty good right now. Consumer confidence is another one, although I'm not a big fan of that myself, because, you know, consumers will often not tell the truth whenever they're talking about whether or not they're confident, and a lot of times that's politically motivated. There's this thing called the yield curve, which people look at, which is a sort of a borrowing indicator that talks about, you know, the differences in borrowing costs that people like to look at. And my personal favorite, which is a little bit of an esoteric one, is the price of copper, because whenever and it's really is a ratio of the price of gold, because whenever an economy is doing very well, usually the price of copper rises because it's used so much in construction, in important parts of construction. And when the price of copper falls, you get the indicator that maybe an economy is softening. And the final one, of course, that everybody looks at is the stock market. I personally think that that's a bit of an inaccurate one, because it can be quite kind of dramatic, the stock market, and can maybe give off some bad signals. So there are a huge, and there's many more than I've just mentioned there, but I think those are some of the more popular ones that we've been hearing about at the Planet Money Indicator over the last year.
Well, let's go back to copper. How is copper doing?
Oh, copper's doing pretty well right now.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think we look pretty good right now. I don't see any, there were some warning signs early this year. This yield curve indicator sort of went off a little bit, and people were worried that we might see a recession there. But that hasn't come to pass. Things are looking a lot more healthy now. I think, the economy is in pretty good shape overall right now.
So right after our economy took a nosedive, now more than a decade ago, I can't believe it, just doesn't feel like that long ago, but it's kept expanding right into the present day. And if it stretches into June, it'll be our country's longest. So to what can we attribute all of this expansion?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that, you know, globally, we've seen a great recovery. You know, people have, and remember where we came from. I mean, we took a real hit there, right, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So we came from we bottomed out pretty hard, and we've made this long, sustained, slow recovery over the last 10 years. And some people say it should have been a lot faster during the Obama administration, that if he'd done some things, you know, deregulated as opposed to put regulations in place, if he'd had, different types of policies, we would have seen a much faster gain. You know, maybe that's right. It's tough to tell. But certainly, you know, the way that the rest of the world was recovering and buying all of our goods was a big help to us. So, you know, a global recovery helps a local recovery. And that's been really, really helpful for the American economy over the last decade.
We have Planet Money's Patty Hirsch in the house breaking down tricky financial concepts, and he's fielding your questions about how money flows in our country. No economics question too big or too small. 800-642-1234. Do you know why the monthly jobs report is a ritual to follow for anyone following markets or the U.S. economy? Do you want to know what data we should keep an eye on as we go about our day-to-day business? And how will Brexit impact our lives here on this side of the pond? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you in a minute on the Ideas Network. Getting straightforward answers to economics and how money flows here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Talking jobless claims, the yield curve, credit spreads, consumer expectations. We hear about leading and lagging indicators. It's all interconnected, a bit tricky around the edges, but It's refreshing to break down financial concepts in clear ways, and that's why we have an All Questions on the Kitchen Table Economics Explainer this hour. What question do you have about our financial system? What do you want to know about how banking works and what to watch for out of the Fed? Your economic questions, big and small, all fair game at 800-642-1234. Patty Hirsch is our guide. He's editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. Patty, let's take a look now at the 8-hour workday. The American labor unions really pushed this back in the 1800s, but it seems like so many Americans just are saying that this is burdensome, it's arbitrary, people work in all these different ways. Do we really need to work 8 hours to be productive?
I don't know whether we need to work 8 hours to be productive. It is the day, of course. It is the time lock, of course, that companies put on what they're going to pay you. But what's interesting about the 8-hour workday is that it's been divided up now. I mean, many more companies are willing to let you be more flexible with your time. They'll say, you know, if you want to work 4 hours in the afternoon and then, 4 hours at night, we can accommodate that because, technology makes that possible. So, 8 hours seems to be the chunk of time. It's almost like they've divided the clock into three, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for play and commute, and eight, if you want to put those two together, and 8 hours for work. So it's an interesting division, but it's interesting to me how progressive companies and companies that are interested in the welfare of their workforce are willing to divide that up now and fractionalize it in a way that they haven't been in the past.
Because there's some trust there. There's trust that employee is being productive in a different space than being in their cubicle.
Yeah, and I think there are many more ways of measuring that now, right? I mean, it's because of the ability to communicate not just on the phone or in person, but, through messaging technology, companies like Slack, these things that people are able to communicate by. But we did a story about a company recently that has, they don't have an office. Everybody is remote. They don't even have a headquarters office, and everybody communicates through these technological means. And Slack is a big one for them, and other types of instant messaging. And they are very, very productive because it allows workers to organize their own day, and as opposed to kind of, sitting around twiddling their thumbs waiting for coffee to brew or whatever it is that you might do in an office, you're actually working during that time.
Well, let's take a call now. Let's go to John joining us from Boaz. Hi, John.
Hi. I love my job. I'm a carpenter. And I have a comment and a question for your guest. I'm a carpenter. I work a lot and I get paid little. But because I love my job, I'm willing to put in 12 hours and I work till I get tired. Then I take a nap and then I go back to work. It's a great feeling to be successful and accomplishing. Now, my question is, my dad was an economics professor. He told me before he died, right after 9/11, that the stock market goes up and down in waves. But when the sine wave gets larger up and larger down, it's preceding a big crash. Are we in that condition right now?
Great question, John. Patty?
Great question. I don't think so, no. I don't think we're seeing the kind of massive sine waves that we saw immediately prior to the 2008 financial crisis, for example. But I think that's true. When you see these massive fluctuations in prices in the markets, it does presage something, pretty dramatic happening. It means that there's a lot of uncertainty and, people are magnifying the movements back and forth. It's like, oh my God, everyone's buying. Oh my gosh, everyone's selling. That's what you're seeing in that sine wave. And that kind of panic can presage a recession. That's true, which is why a lot of people look at the stock market and say it can be an indicator, but can also send off some negative signals because you never know how big that sine wave is supposed to be. I mean, it might look dramatic, but in actual fact, that the sine wave that's going to really be the precursor to an actual recession could be a lot bigger. And these days, those movements in the market are magnified much more by algorithmic trading, right? You've got machines that are trading, and they are actually, a lot of people say that they pile on to the effects that you see caused by humans and cause these bigger waves, but they also correct those movements much more quickly because they're able to do that much more quickly than a human being can do. Regarding your work situation, boy, I'm very, very envious of you. And, you know, to me, this speaks to one of the greatest engines of productivity, which is worker happiness. Right? I suspect that you're self-employed and that you, because you work your own routine and you're happy in your work, that makes you so much more productive. And I think that that is one of the things that companies look at when they look at dividing up the workday and make the workday more flexible. They're saying to themselves, what's going to make our workers happier? Because that happiness, that contentedness in their work is going to make them more productive. And I think that those two things go together, and it's one of the reasons why you are starting to see American companies being much more flexible in the way that they allow their workers to work.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Marv joining us from Burl. Hi, Marv.
Hello. Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, some years ago, I asked a friend of mine, an economist, how the European Union Central Bank was set up for each new country that came in. I got a long discussion of the fact that it should not be able to work because of the divergent nature of the economies in the European Union. However, that was not my question. My question was a value-neutral technical accounting question, which is this. How is a new country who enters the European Union, let's take Macedonia as an example, how is it determined how many euros that country is able to have? How is it distributed to that country, presumably through a Macedonian central bank of some sort? And how does that number of euros change over a period of years? That's just a basic accounting question.
Wow, okay, that's a... Well, I have never experienced a question quite as technical and granular as that. And I'm going to say, I'm going to admit, it's hard for me to admit this, but I do not know the specifics of the answer to that question. What I do know is, though...
That may be why my friend, the PhD economist who worked with Lehman Brothers, declined to answer it and went into that long spiel, which was very interesting, about the divergent economies, the backward economies and the advanced economies, et cetera.
But yeah, and he's right. And in a way, when you look at the European Central Bank and the European Economic Union, or the European Monetary Union, it is this weird kind of hydra, this beast that actually shouldn't actually exist because of all of the offsets. You have these incredibly divergent economies as part of a single economy. It shouldn't really exist. But then other people might compare that to the American economy and say, you know, you have very, very comparatively poor states in the United States that are actually connected to very wealthy states in the United States, and that seems to work. So why shouldn't it work in Europe? And certainly that's what the Europeans pointed to when they started this great experiment of the European Monetary Union. What I can tell you, though, is that whenever the assessment is made of how many euros should flow to a new joiner to the European Monetary Union, there's a very, you know, they calibrate that very, very carefully as a comparative. And as the economy grows or shrinks, the European Central Bank does annual assessments of those new joiners, in fact, of every country, to see how much euro money should actually flow to that country or not.
Well, there's no elegant segue to this, Patty, but the indicator has been looking at tipping recently and has tried to learn why the tipping culture in America is so strong. What did you find out?
Well, we found out that people really don't want to let go of tipping, and that's both on the tipper side and the tippee side. We found that we spoke to a chap who's done a lot of research in the restaurant and hotel business about tipping, who find that, you know, if you have restaurants, and there are restaurants out there now that include tips, service charges, in their menu items, that obviously the unit price of those menus are going to be more expensive, but obviously they're not going to include a tip. But people prefer to go to restaurants that don't have those higher prices, even though in the end they may pay less at those restaurants than they would at a restaurant where they're actually paying the tip on top themselves, an optional tip, which makes no economic sense at all, but just shows how ingrained into the American restaurant culture, or the American dining culture, tipping actually is. And the same thing goes on the other side. Servers tend to prefer to be paid in a tip because they believe in their heads that it has, that they have more control over how much they're going to get paid at the end, even though that is actually not the case. And in fact, maybe only 12% of the end of the bill, the final bill, they have any actual control over whether or not they get paid a lot or a little. So it makes absolutely no economic sense to tip, and it makes absolutely no economic sense to want to be tipped. And yet we still tip and we still want to be tipped. And it's just ingrained in our culture. And it's something that will take a very, very long time to get rid of.
We're breaking down concepts in our economy, the labor market, tipping. Patty Hirsch, our guide, he's editor of the Planet Money podcast, The Indicator. Your thoughts on the job market here in Wisconsin, they're welcome as well at 800-642-1234. Do you hold multiple jobs? Perhaps you're a carpenter. Maybe you're looking for greener pastures. Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. News is next, and then we'll pick up the conversation with a closer look at housing right here on the Ideas Network. All economics questions matter this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're breaking down the markets and recent financial news, putting it into context as to how this all hits our own pocketbooks. And fresh data out of the Commerce Department yesterday, the number of homes being built in December dropped to the lowest level in more than 2 years. We'll be talking about that. But before housing, some more thoughts on tipping. We've been talking about tips with Patty Hirsch. She's editor of the NPR Planet Money podcast, The Indicator. Let's go to another call now with Dan in Drummond. Hi, Dan.
Hello. We have a business up here in the North Woods called the Delta Diner. And about 4 years ago, the owner wanted to get away from tipping having people tip. So what he turned around and did, he gave all his employees a $15 an hour raise. Now, this place is so popular that people come to eat there from all over the United States.
So tips have been eliminated at this diner, Patty, and the wages now for the employees are $15 an hour.
Well, I think that's great. You know, and I'm not saying that in places it doesn't work. I mean, there are restaurants that are experimenting this, and some big name chefs, I think, that are experimenting with this in various parts of the country. It's heartening to hear that it's happening in Wisconsin as well. I mean, that's great news. But overall, we've seen that the majority of people tend not to like this. Now, I'm hoping that this will change because, you know, as someone who believes in the power of economics and also comes from a land that, you know, doesn't actually have tipping as part of its culture, in restaurants in particular, I would love to see this change. It just makes things so much more transparent. You go to a place, you see what the charge of the for the meal is, of whatever it is that you're ordering or whatever it is that you're buying. You know that the staff are getting treated well and they're getting a good daily wage that they're going to be able to live off. To me, that's the best option. That's great, and it's great to hear that's got some traction in Wisconsin. I would love to see it sweep the nation, but unfortunately, it seems from the research the people that we've been talking to who've done significant research into this, that's not the way that most Americans like it. But, you know, everyone's up for change, and who isn't up for change more than Americans, right?
Let's go to Glenn now in Minocqua. Glenn, hi. Good morning.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to push back on the speaker and your guest on tipping. I've got 5 kids up here in the Northwoods. They've all worked as servers at restaurants this summer, and they routinely do better than a lot of their peers because they're better servers, and it shows up in their tips, and they get rewarded by it. Not only my daughter's sons have had $250, $300, $350 nights. I'm sorry, but a $15 raise isn't close to that. Plus, the owner of the restaurant or the managers see who's getting bigger tips, and they reward them with more shifts, as they should, because they're working harder and they're better at it. Plus, as a diner, I don't see any lack of transparency. I know what the cost of food is. And I'll tip accordingly. I'm generally a generous tipper, but sometimes less if the service is bad. Why should everybody get paid the same if they're not working, if they're not as good a server? I feel strongly about this.
Glenn, I'm trying to think of someone who could have made that case better than you did just there. All right, that is absolutely the case that people make for tipping on both sides. You know, that is what servers say, that they believe that they can, that if they provide better service, they're going to get better tips. Unfortunately, people have found, and there's a great deal of research that's been done into this, it's been found that if you are African-American or if you have darker skin, you're going to get tipped less. Also, if you're a female, if you conform to a more specific body type, you're going to get tipped more. If you're blonde, you get tipped more than if you're brunette. So, you know, there are a lot of people who would look at that part of the statistic or the data and say, you know, tipping isn't fair, and it only benefits certain types of people, and therefore it should be eliminated. On the other side, there are those who would, of course, say, you know, I've done very well from tipping. I'd rather not be included in a non-tip restaurant because I can believe I can do better. And of course, then there are people like you who pay close attention, which is great, to menu prices and know what it is that you're going to tip or not tip, and you're going to be very happy with that. And there are a lot, like I say, the majority of Americans who dine in restaurants feel that way. So you made that case very, very well for me. Thank you.
Patty Hirsch with us, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money, gathering your economic questions. 800-642-1234. What was your experience during the housing crisis 10 years ago? How has that changed how you behave today when it comes to real estate? Or were you insulated during this? What is your story? You can call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Patty, let's turn to these expensive boxes that people buy, as you talk about. Commerce Department had new numbers out for residential construction in December. We saw a slowdown in home building. How significant is that?
Well, that's the key to the problem, right? I mean, people talk about a housing crisis. I'm not sure that there is a housing crisis. Certainly, people who are, you know, coming out of college and trying to get into houses for the first time to buy a home, they find it difficult because housing prices are very high in certain parts of the country, and not so high in other parts of the country, but in some parts of the country they are very high. But the fact is that this is a supply and demand issue. There's a great deal of demand for housing, and we're not building enough. You know, when you talk about looking at indicators for the economy, when you start to see a home builder saying, you know, we're not actually that confident about building houses, we don't want to build that many houses because we don't believe that they're going to get bought at the prices that we want to get bought at, that is an indicator that perhaps there are some headwinds in the economy. And because, you know, like I say, those boxes that people buy, they fill them with stuff. They borrow and they spend their savings in order to fill those, to buy that stuff, to put in those boxes. And that's what drives the economy. I mean, this is primarily a consumer spending driven economy. And so, you know, housing is exceptionally important. But the biggest issue that we have in housing right now is that we're not building enough houses. And that is why, certainly on the coasts and in many urban areas, housing prices are so high and people are having such difficulty getting into their homes.
Well, let's talk about mortgages with Paul joining us from Middleton with a question. Hi, Paul.
Good morning to you both. And forgive my rather simpleton-like question. But we know that the stock market and the bond market operate in inverse relation to each other. The market's up, the bond market's down, the bond market's up, the stock market's down, generally speaking. And the mortgage rates are usually tied to the 10-year T-bills of the federal government. So my question, and then earlier, at the end of last year, various economists, I guess, from various financial institutions were asked about their projections for mortgage rates for the year, or how they would end up in 2019, and all of them said they would be gradually rising. Well, we've had the exact opposite. They've been generally falling over time, admittedly not fast, but definitely falling perceptibly. So my question to your guest is, what's going on and why is this happening? Another question is, why is there such disparity within financial institutions for mortgage rates?
Well, it's not a simpleton question at all. In fact, it's a very technical question.
Sorry.
Paul, it's a great question. But it goes back to your question about mortgage rates, goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show about the Fed chairman talking about whether or not to increase or decrease interest rates. Because, yes, you're right. mortgages quite often are based off the 10-year Treasury note. But the 10-year Treasury note isn't going to go up. Its rate isn't going to go up unless, of course, the Federal Reserve increases interest rates at the very, very base level. And it's not doing that. It's making a conscious decision not to do that. And it looks like that's going to be the way that it's going to go throughout the year, as I see it, certainly, and a lot of other private economists see it. So because you're not seeing those base rates rise, you're not going to see the 10-year Treasury note rise, which means you're not going to see a large increase in mortgage rates, which again plays into this issue about the housing crisis, because the so-called housing crisis, the difficulty that people are having in actually buying homes. It's not because of pricing, because mortgage rates are at incredibly low rates. I mean, you can get mortgages for 4.5-5%. I mean, that's nothing compared to what people were getting them at before the financial crisis. So rates are still exceptionally low.
So, and to Paul's kind of second part of the question, perhaps he kind of hinted at it, but why do you see different commercial vendors offering mortgage rates at different rates, and why the variance there?
I think that's just their business, right? I mean, banks are always competing for customers, and mortgage lenders are always competing for customers. And, they're all of their businesses are individually different. You may get a break at some other point if you did a sort of a package bundle with a bank in order to get a mortgage. You might get a break somewhere else on another loan. I mean, they're just individual companies that are offering different prices. But I don't think the variances are that enormous. I mean, you're talking about percentages of a point rather than whole points. Mm. When you're talking about these variances, it's not like you're talking about a 1% or 2% difference. You're talking about an 18th or a 16th or a 0.25% variance. But I think that's really just down to their individual businesses.
How much do credit scores matter anymore? I mean, is a borrower's credit still have to be pretty pristine, or are banks kind of loosening up lending?
Oh yeah, I mean, credit scores are extraordinarily important, and banks are in a tough position in many ways. I don't want to be sort of an apologist and shedding tears for banks too much, but think about the situation that they're in. On one hand, they're being told, "Oh, you guys were the architects of the financial crisis because you gave crazy loans to people. You need to tighten up your act and be more stern and strict about the kind of loans that you're offering." On the other hand, people are going to them and looking at them and saying, "Hey, why aren't you guys lending to people? People need mortgages in order to buy homes. You guys are the problems because you aren't lending." So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place in many ways, which is maybe where banks should be. But it's a tough position for them to be in, to walk that line between providing a service, providing the loans to people in order to keep the housing market going, but also making sure that they're not a credit risk either to themselves or to the economy as a whole.
We're exploring economic questions this hour with Planet Money's podcast editor Patty Hirsch as our guide. What questions do you have about trade policy, about tariffs and their impact on our overall economy? How will a trade war with China impact what we see on the shelves of Target? We're making connections on economic concepts all over the place. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Back in a minute with more Patty Hirsch on the Ideas Network. Straightforward answers to the curious economic questions that we just can't quite wrap our heads around. We're gathering your questions, looking at how money flows here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and here we are in the thick of tax season with a new tax law. Treasury Department tweaked things so that, on average, taxpayers' withholdings fell by more than their actual taxes owed. But then how does taxes fit into the larger flow of how the U.S. economy works? Good question to ask. We're getting answers here at 800-642-1234. Patty Hirsch, our guide. He is the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. Patty, before we move on, let's take a look at how rural communities are doing, small towns are doing. We had a report saying that vacancy rates that were just about double the rates in metropolitan areas. Are small towns just struggling harder economically than urban areas right now?
It depends on the small town. Okay. But certainly in parts of the United States, yes. I mean, there are parts of the United States where, you know, the traditional industry that existed in those areas has left. I mean, those traditional industries have closed. I mean, whether it's steel or it's coal mining, you've seen communities languish because those businesses have either wrapped up shop or they've moved on. But what was interesting is we've done some work on NPR recently about rural communities that are actually doing better despite the demise of the industries in those areas. One of our reporters, Kirk Siegler, was in Colorado recently talking to people who live in a coal mining community, and I think 2/3 of the capacity of the coal mines in that area had just closed down for a variety of reasons, not least the cost of transportation of coal from those areas. But now it turns out that those areas are booming, and the reason is because they are areas of outstanding natural beauty, and people want to live there. And because of the advances in technology that we've seen in the last maybe only 10 years, where you're starting to see broadband internet, genuine broadband internet, not the sort of junky stuff that a lot of the time you hear about, you know, the ability to communicate well with people in, you know, remote locations through broadband internet, that has increased dramatically in the last decade. And it means that people can live and work in these communities far, you know, hours drive away from cities, because they don't need to be in those cities. They can actually, you know, live and work in the place, in the same place, and it doesn't have to be close to a large urban area. And you are starting to see resurgences in those, in certain parts of the country. So it's a kind of a mixed bag, as always, but it's not all bad news at all. And in actual fact, you are seeing some, you know, some genuine urban regeneration.
Well, we would be remiss without talking about the back and forth about tariffs and what's happening between the U.S. and China. We heard President Trump Sunday saying he'd delay increases in tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports. So what should we be watching for here as we look at how the U.S. and China is working through these trade talks?
Well, you know, this is going to play out, and let's be you know, very specific about what's going on in these trade talks. These are the same trade talks, okay, that have been going on, you know, since the first Bush administration. In fact, before, we've always had the same complaints about China's economy. All right, we've always wanted China to make structural changes in the economy that create better business conditions. We've always wanted better protection for intellectual property rights. We've always wanted China to stop forcing our companies to hand over technology. We've always wanted China to give us more access to its markets. It's not something that, you know, those are negotiations that the Obama administration was having, that the Clinton administration was having, that the Bush administration was having. We're just having the same conversations, but we're just using a heavier stick to do the beating with than we have in the past. So, you know, those are the areas of contention remain exactly the same. We're just looking for China to give ground in this area. Unfortunately, although we're probably winning all of the battles in this war, where it's, you know, China in some ways needs the U.S. more than the U.S. needs China, the problem is that China is able to play a much longer game than the U.S. is, right? You know, Donald Trump himself is looking forward to his next election, right? President Xi in China doesn't have to look forward to his next election. He's pretty much a president for as long as he wants to be president. Mm. So, you know, they're able to play and that's always been the case with China. They're able to play a much, much longer game. Yes, they are weaker. Yes, they're probably losing all of those battles, but they can afford to fight for a heck of a lot longer than America can.
So when do we see the trickle down to the goods that we buy in the aisles of our supermarket and these tariffs hitting home in our pocketbooks?
Oh, well, I mean, we're already seeing it. You know, it's there, but it's not that magnified. What's really interesting is that, you know, it's costing American producers who are being shut out of China in many ways or being restricted, it's costing them in quite, you know, dramatic ways, whether it's, you know, farmers who are growing soybeans or, you know, steel manufacturers or whatever it may be. It's costing those American business. But what's interesting, the majority of American businesses are still for the tariffs because, you know, they've seen these, you know, one of the things that I've mentioned is that this is a conversation that's been going on for many, many years. but nothing's ever really, nothing has come of it as quickly as people want. There is a perception that maybe tariffs and, you know, a trade war is the way to go in order to squeeze these concessions out of the Chinese. You know, only time will tell, as we don't like to say in journalism. You know, we're gonna have to see, because it's a gamble that Donald Trump's administration is putting forward. It's a gamble that American businesses are making, but they're thinking that, you know, maybe this could pay off. But, you know, it's costing them, no question.
Okay, Patty. So it's tax season right now. Have you done your taxes?
Absolutely, I have indeed. Yes, and
okay.
When I say have I done my taxes, I think my wife has done our taxes because she is a genius at this, and I am really not.
Fair enough. Thank you for that. But you know, the returns are down this year compared to last year. Some people are being surprised to find themselves owing the government money.
Yeah.
So why is this happening, and how will this impact our economy?
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to impact the economy that much. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how low returns are in a year, because, you know, the IRS has got a lot of catching up to do, right? I mean, firstly, the IRS has been drawn down in terms of its capacity. And secondly, it's been really surprised in many ways by the changes in the tax law, which I think are causing a lot of upset. A lot of people were expecting to get refunds this year as a result of the changes in the tax law, but they're actually, you know, being dinged by the IRS. And I think that's, a lot of people are a little bit upset about that. And certainly, you know, I work in Los Angeles, and a lot of people in Hollywood here who are getting really heavily smacked, who are very, very surprised by that. So I think a lot of nasty surprises for people in the tax code this year. I'm not exactly sure how low, again, those returns are going to be. But, you know, of course, that is the major, that's the place where America gets its money, right? You know, America as a government gets its revenues from taxes. We tax and we spend. That's what the Treasury does. That's the engine of where we get the money to build roads and schools and, well, not schools necessarily, unless they're federal schools, but which of course don't exist. But so, you know, all of those types of infrastructure around the country that require federal spending, that money comes from tax returns. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how much shortfall there is. I don't think it's going to be that bad. But it'll take a little while before we actually know, because people still haven't figured it out yet.
Well, Patty, you should be very pleased. I'm leaving you a whole 30 seconds to make me care a lot about Brexit. So go.
So you don't have to care that much about Brexit. You know, Britain is not a huge trade partner with the United States. It's not like there's huge amounts of money sloshing back and forth between the two. So as an American, you don't need to worry about it that much. If you're if you're Irish, you might be quite hopeful about it. You might think, well, maybe this is an opportunity to forge a closer bond between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, because the biggest sticking point to Brexit right now is the physical border between Europe and Britain, which is that border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. And the establishment of that border could be a tricky thing, because you know, once you've got a border where goods cost different amounts on either side, then you've got smuggling and you've got gangs and you've got the need to harden that border. And if that happens, then you may see some problems in Northern Ireland, and we could be right back to 1972, which could be a bad thing. So,
well,
that's a reason to care in a negative way.
Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate.
Patty Hirsch.
Thank you to your listeners.
Yes, Patty Hirsch is editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. He's been an economics and finance news correspondent and editor for 20 years. His book, Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple, breaks down our financial system. Coming up after the morning show, former lawyer for President Trump, Michael Cohen, will testify as part of a public hearing held by the U.S. House Oversight Committee. It'll air on the Ideas Network and at WPR.org. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is the Ideas Network.